The Playlist with Ben and Fiona.
And you can't say that that happens very often in life.
Welcome to The Playlist, where we talk about movies and TV shows that are worth your time. I'm Fiona Williams, and I manage our online coverage of movies and TV here at SBS. And I'm joined by my co-host, SBS and SBS Viceland channel manager, Ben Nguyen. Hello, Ben.
Hi, Fee.
How are you?
I am good. So on today's episode of The Playlist, Lin-Manuel Miranda's semi-autobiographical love letter to the Washington Heights Latinx community in the Heights. Tom Hiddleston resurfaces as the god of mischief alongside Owen Wilson in Loki. And as we're recording this on my very last day at SBS, I might indulge myself in some of the shows I've been most proud of.
Well, we can't wait for that. We'll just make this a very, very long podcast. So you have to stick around a bit longer.
13 years of content.
He's just going to read out the guide for the last 13 years. People get comfortable. Yes, we'll delay that.
But first, yes, that's right. But first, In the Heights. So Lin-Manuel Miranda's 2005 stage musical about life, love, immigration and gentrification has been somewhat eclipsed by his follow-up, which launched 10 years later, a certain show called Hamilton. But it shouldn't be forgotten that In the Heights was also a big success when it launched on Broadway in 2008, taking away multiple Tonys, including for Best Musical. And it's the international success of Hamilton that has allowed In the Heights to be adapted for the screen from the director John Chu, who most recently made the groundbreaking hit Crazy Rich Asians, but is himself a dancer and directed iterations of the hip-hop dance movies Step Up. In the Heights follows various generations of the Washington Heights Latinx community in Upper Manhattan, New York City, centering around the owner of a small bodega, Usnavi de la Vega, originally played on stage by Miranda, but here ably embodied by Hamilton alum Anthony Ramos, who dreams of returning to his homeland, the Dominican Republic. Let's hear a bit.
Usnavi, and you probably never heard my name. Reports of my fame are greatly exaggerated.
Morning, Usnavi.
Pan caliente, café con leche.
On these blocks, you can't walk two steps without bumping into someone's big plan.
I'm making moves, I'm making deals, but guess what?
What?
You still ain't got no skills. I've been saving up all my pennies in my piggy bank for this day.
This is going to be an emotional roller coaster. The odds are against you.
But there's a chance, right? A dream isn't some sparkly diamond. There's no shortcuts. Sometimes it's rough.
Fee, this is a glossy spectacle which attempts to capture the heart and soul of a migrant community without sacrificing commercial appeal. Does it succeed?
Look, I had a great time with it, actually. Like you say, it's all spectacle and it's vibrant and super sunshiny as well.
Yeah.
It's a good time. And the dancing's fantastic. The characters are all gorgeous and fun. So, I had a good time with it. It takes some creative license midway through. There's some fantastic dance numbers. Yeah, I came out of it going, that was a good time.
Yeah, I had seen a stage production. And so a lot of my thinking walking out was a bit of that compare and contrast and, you know, how much sort of held up and how much was lost in the adaptation to the screen.
Yes.
I mean, I definitely enjoyed it. I think it didn't fully recapture the experience for me of seeing it on stage. And that's always a challenge. I mean, Hamilton, the version that was released internationally, was just a recording of the original Broadway cast, whereas this is, you know, very much a sort of musical for the cinema.
Yes.
And there's some really sort of cute things they do with that, some fun staging. There's a kind of duet that comes sort of later on in the show where the two characters dance sort of semi-vertically with a bit of camera trickery on the side of a New York brownstone kind of building. And there's some, you know, nice little nods, I guess, to musical eras of the past. But I felt like the most vibrant moments and the moments which most worked for me really were those celebrations of the community where you really had everyone coming out onto the streets. I don't think it's a spoiler to say there is a kind of big blackout that kind of brings all the story strands together and I guess sort of forces a lot of the characters to confront the various things that have been going on in their life and the various secrets that they've been hiding. And there's a great scene where just everyone is sort of out on the streets together, realizing what it is that's important about this community and this sort of area of New York that they're from.
Yeah.
And those moments I really, really loved.
Yeah, totally. It is a celebration. And also I saw it in a cinema with a crowd and it benefits from that too, I think. Like it's about a community. There's a communal experience to watching it in a cinema on a big screen and with your surround sound. It is fun to watch.
I've seen it struggled a little bit at the box office in the US, perhaps weighted down by overly high expectations because I think this is a story about a specific migrant community. I don't think it is like a big commercial smash hit really. I guess sort of the Crazy Rich Asians success and also the success of Hamilton have kind of put a lot on its shoulders.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. But I do think it'll benefit from word of mouth. So, I mean, there's so much emphasis on the opening weekend, et cetera, but the way the world is
Some
people also don't want to go to the cinema at the moment. Mm. We were talking international box office. Yeah, like take it with a grain of salt, I think. And also it's very well reviewed for communities seeing themselves on screen. Let's not, you know, diminish that aspect of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's also communities who aren't represented. And that's been a whole other side conversation that Lin-Manuel Miranda has acknowledged that not everyone in the Latin community is represented on screen. So that's been a conversation.
That's right. Yeah. And apologized for not being conscious enough of Afro-Latino representation. And, you know, in the US, it's also was simultaneously released on HBO Max. But I think that, you know, here in Australia where you can go out and see it in a cinema, that is the right place to go and see it.
I think so. Yeah, it's a good time in the cinema. And you can take your family. It's quite a wholesome movie too. That's not that it's like it is.
Definitely.
It's a good musical family.
There's a bit of a framing device in the movie musical, which wasn't there on stage, where he's sort of retelling this story to a bunch of kids. And, you know, it does work on that level. I think, you know, I think kids sort of will connect with this. I think that for people who love Hamilton and haven't seen In the Heights, there's a lot of familiarity that I think people will get into. I mean, it becomes very clear, I think, where the attraction of the Hamilton story of an immigrant young man who had come to America from the Caribbean to kind of make his way and through his wits managed to succeed. And, you know, there's a lot of that here as well.
Yeah.
And a really nice portrayal of male friendships that manages to avoid that toxicity of some masculine relationships. And we saw that in Hamilton as well.
Mm. Yeah, good point. And with the music and it, you know, I'm not sure what the time frame was between In the Heights and Hamilton, but yeah, you can see the evolution of like even just the musical stylings of Lin-Manuel Miranda. You can really see the connections between the two.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm. That sort of the influences of both big Broadway show stoppers and the rhythms of hip hop and salsa and things in this particular story that he's kind of worked in.
Mm-hmm. And Anthony Ramos is so charming as the lead. He's got a great screen presence, but there's also just great performances all around. There's kind of the core 4 to 5 leads in this. There's Leslie Grace, Melissa Barrera, and Jimmy Smits. It's great to see him in a film. You know, I haven't seen Jimmy Smits for years. I used to watch L.A. Law.
Yeah. So. Yeah, yeah. No, he's got a lovely presence. Mm. You know, maybe not the strongest pipes, but
He's sort of the Pierce Brosnan at the music. Yeah.
But I think, he brings this sort of lovely tone as the father figure. Well, the father of young Nina, who's played by Leslie Grace, who's gone away to college, dropped out of college, which he doesn't know, and he's been making all these sacrifices in order to get her there. Mm-hmm. So there is all that intergenerational hopes and dreams that I think are very true of, in particular, I think, migrants who come to a new country with the intention to build a new life for themselves. Yeah. I think that it really does capture that.
I think it does. Yeah, not in the same way, but in the way Minari works so well in that connecting through to that, you know, the risk and the hopes. Yeah, there's a through line there, I think, that captures it really well.
Yeah. Both good films.
Mm, yes.
So that's In the Heights, and it's out in cinemas now. V, do you have a favourite musical on screen?
On screen. Well, I do love Singing in the Rain.
Oh, yeah.
Such a good movie.
Yeah. Yeah, when I think of movie musicals, I do often think back to when Stanley Donen, who was director of Singing in the Rain, and when he received an honorary Oscar in 1998, and he gave a wonderful speech. He was given the Oscar by Martin Scorsese, and he did say that when you can't articulate the words, I'm paraphrasing, but the words that you want to say, that's when you break into song in a movie musical. And so he did break into song in his speech, which was gorgeous. But there can be such joy from movie musicals.
Absolutely. Yeah, they're wonderful. And, I mean, there are some bad ones too, don't get me wrong. But probably my two favourites now that I think about it, definitely Singing in the Rain. I can watch that anytime. And All That Jazz is a whole different kind of musical, but it is extraordinary for the way Bob Fosse tells his own life story in song. It's so dark and spectacular at the same time. And yeah, probably those two are my favourites. Mm.
I think my favourite would definitely be Parapluie de Cherbourg, the Umbrellas of Cherbourg, and which is entirely sung through. So there's no breaking into song. It just is entirely song, which I watched originally. Actually, yeah, I saw originally on the stage, there was a stage version, but it originated as a screen musical. Mm. And then I was desperate to watch that, so did, and the only place I could find it was on YouTube, which wasn't the ideal viewing experience necessarily, but I was very, very taken in by this sort of love story within a very working class French town that then kind of gets overwhelmed by the war in Algeria in the 1960s. So, Catherine Deneuve is stunning. I don't think it's her real voice who's singing, but she's amazing, and the colours are very, very wonderful.
Yeah, the design of the whole thing is amazing.
Mm.
Interesting. I did not know that was your favourite musical.
Yes. Sometimes I find it very, very hard to name a favourite and don't like being put on the spot, but that one's an easy one for me. It did lead me into thinking about musicals on TV, because there have been multiple attempts to try and, I guess, adapt the musical form into an ongoing TV series. Mm. Not all of them successful. I was reminded of Cop Rock, which was from the creative Hill Street Blues. It was a big bomb in 1990. And I went back and looked at a clip of it again on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
And very odd mix of this sort of handheld camera, this sort of real realism, overlapping dialogue in the police station, and then suddenly breaking into song.
Yeah.
But I guess sort of some musicals manage it by keeping that fantasy alive. Some of them manage it by just trying to set the storyline in a world where people would actually perform. So there was Smash that was set in the world of Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
And Glee, which was obviously about it was a sort of fairly straight musical, but it was set around a singing class. And more recently, I was sort of catching up with Zoe's Extraordinary Playlist, which had its second season playing out this year, but just has been axed by NBC. Mm. But I did enjoy this. This used the kind of pretext was that Zoe, in an earthquake, was in an MRI machine and then sort of magically developed the ability to hear people's innermost thoughts as song and dance numbers.
I think they had some music playing while she was having the MRI, and then that, all of the songs on the internet or something get sucked into her brain.
Exactly.
Whatever, go with it. But
but it's an excuse, for a lot of popular music.
Yes.
So it's a real jukebox musical where people kind of get to sort of have that moment of, like Stanley Donen said, of where you can't express how you're feeling, break into a song.
Chuck a song in there. What is the music budget on that?
Oh,
right, clearance.
Extraordinary, I'm sure. Mm. But I think, it did some clever things around sort of really being about the creator's personal experience of having his father dying of a degenerative disease and being in a bit of a vegetative state. Mm. And so the fantasy scenario here is that what if the way that I could reconnect with my father is that he was actually able to sing to me how he really felt.
Yeah, it's gorgeous.
Mm. Yeah.
One I have liked, and I stopped watching for some reason. I need to go back to it, but Crazy Ex-Girlfriend was, you know, that kind of this new breed of musical comedy, short burst, but all the razzle-dazzle and production values of a movie musical, but in weekly sitcom-y
episodes. Yeah, no, I'm a big fan of Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, and I think it did some really interesting things dealing with mental health.
Totally, yeah.
And the fact that you are breaking the fourth wall every time you break into song, and this was a way to explore, you know, someone that was going through a lot of mental health issues. So, yeah, very, very clever, smart show.
And I can't think of any others. Should we fill this gap with song?
I'm not brave enough, I think, to break into song at this minute. You know, get a few drinks into me and a good karaoke bar, and then we might be talking.
All right, we'll take that offline.
So the MCU, the Marvel Cinematic Universe, has a new show out. I don't think anyone breaks into song here, but, you know, we're only two episodes in. Let's have a little chat about Loki.
It's going to be one-sided.
Viewers will, I think, have decided long ago whether they're in or out of the MCU. And unlike the recent WandaVision, which stood up on its own as a bold piece of television, I'm not sure there's anything here for newcomers in the new series Loki. Loki himself, as played by Tom Hiddleston, has been through a significant character arc across multiple films, finding redemption and peace in his strained relationship with the Asgardian gods that make up his family, the destruction of his homeland, and his death at the hands of Thanos. We're given a rapid reminder of this timeline for the benefit of this Loki, a variant who has slipped out of the time span of the first Avengers movie, and as a result has been taken under the control of the Time Variance Authority and the watchful eye of Agent Mobius M. Mobius Owen Wilson. Confused yet? Let's have a listen.
I know what this place is. The timekeepers have built quite the circus. And I see the clowns are playing their parts to perfection. Big metaphor guy. I love it. Makes you sound super smart.
I am smart.
I know.
Okay.
Okay.
Please sign to verify this is everything you've ever said.
This is absurd.
Sign this too.
The positive thing about the absurdity of this setup is that it has been embraced by director Kate Herron, who plays off the Terry Gilliam-esque bureaucracy required to keep something as simple as the timeline headed in a straight line. And there's a real pleasure in the brutalist architecture of these endless offices and the 1970s colour palette of brown and orange. Fee, I don't think you've had a chance to catch up with Loki as of yet.
I have not. So when you said confused much, I was like, yeah, 100% have not watched it. But please, go on. What do you think?
Yeah, well, I think even in just trying to distill the storyline and the setup to this show, it really does expect that you have had these, you know, about a decade now of Marvel experience. But I have always really liked the Thor outings in the Marvel universe. The first one was directed by Kenneth Branagh, who brought a kind of Shakespearean pathos to the outings, to the affairs, and actors like Anthony Hopkins really helped that. And Chris Hemsworth, you know, always did a great job. I think, you know, he's in some ways an underrated actor. You know, he's got great comedy chops as well, which Taika Waititi in the most recent Thor movie, Ragnarok, kind of really utilized really well.
Yeah.
And Loki's kind of been the supporting character throughout all of that. And so here he's thrust into the limelight as the star of his own series. But yeah, no, I think there's a lot to like here. I think the production design feels very distinct from, you know, what we've seen in other Marvel outings. The director, Kate Herron, has described it as a mix of brutalism and Midwestern architecture, and that's probably it's probably hit the nail of kind of, you know, what they've achieved. Mm. And so there's something, very mundane about this authority who has the job of making sure that the timeline, you know, plays on the straight and narrow and doesn't sort of go off on weird tangents. Yeah, and of course, Loki here has been enlisted to help because there's someone nefarious out there that has plans to play loose and wild with the official version of events, as it were.
Okay. So when having watched the Avengers, all of them, whatever, I have been a bit one to miss a few, but I did watch Endgame, both of them.
Yeah.
Well, you know what I mean? And WandaVision, and there is a timeline here. Has all that happened? And
yeah, so.
And did you say that? And I was still confused about what you were talking about.
Well, this is specifically leads out from Endgame.
Right.
So people who have seen Endgame will know there's a bit of a time heist that happens where they have to kind of go back through the events of previous films. And if people remember, they capture Loki at the end of Avengers.
Okay.
And he's being transported down in an elevator in the Marvel building. The Avengers building.
Marvel
Whatever.
Same time.
Yeah. See, I'm losing track now. And then he makes an escape, and that's just sort of left hanging in Endgame. Mm. So this is what picks up directly from that. We even see a replay of that scene at the beginning.
Right. Okay, good.
So it is Loki as he was back then, which was a villain, but he quickly gets caught up in events, and so we kind of catch this version of Loki up to current day Loki, who's not a villain.
Gotcha. You absolutely didn't get me, but okay. I'll need to go watch that. You recommend?
You know, it's definitely one for the Marvel faithful.
Oh.
But there is a lot to enjoy here, and Owen Wilson, I think, is well cast in his sort of, you know, laconic Texan persona as this sort of a bit of a square peg in the round hole of this bureaucracy who has the idea that, you know, we can take this guy who really is meant to be extinguished for the sake of the timeline, and maybe we can use him in some outrageous ways to sort of catch someone who's out there causing trouble. So I think it's sort of probably more, it's a bit more outrageous and a bit more fun than Falcon and Winter Soldier was, which was very sort of by the books, but less creative than WandaVision.
Yeah, right. See, I didn't bother with Falcon and the Winter Soldier because I've just coming off the high. I loved WandaVision.
Yeah.
So I didn't really feel like going back into the conventional kind of Marvel story. But okay, I might give Loki a try.
And I think it is nice to see Marvel finally embracing more women directors in their work. And so, you know, alongside this series, we've also got Kate Shortland, fellow Canberran, directing the Black Widow film that comes out in a heartbeat. And
much delayed. So, it'd be good to see that finally get out.
And, of course, Chloe Zhao, who just won the Oscar, has her own Marvel movie coming out sometime later in the Marvel timeline. As long as it doesn't get messed around too much.
See what you did there, I think. And how do you watch it?
So it's dropping weekly on Disney Plus.
Of course it is. Okay.
Yeah.
Great. All right. We can't avoid it any longer. Next segment, we're going to devote to you, Ben, because as you dropped at the top of the show, you're out of here. This is your last day at SBS. Last playlist, I guess. We were pretending that you might be able to keep doing this at your new job, but maybe we need to face the facts.
Yeah, so let's never say never, you know, just like, you know, Sean Connery and James Bond.
Smooth.
But I am headed over to Stan, you know, one of our frenemies, we might say, in the TV and streaming world as their new director of programming. And I know that I leave SBS in very safe hands, and it's been a wonderful pleasure doing this podcast with you, Fee, of all the duties and activities that have been required of me over more than a decade at SBS.
That is the right answer, but thank you. It's been so fun doing this with you. And look, we started at SBS similar timing.
I know.
So, yes, to see you off, this being our final playlist together. It's just been the best time talking movies and TV and Oscars and all of this fun with you. Not as often in the studio as we had anticipated because we all went to our houses last year, so we had to do the whole Zoom thing. And once again, sorry for that whole episode that my recorder stopped working and we had to redo. But anyway, sorry to producer Jeremy.
Yeah, we're peeling behind the curtain right
exactly.
now.
Oh, look, all the secrets come out in the last one. No, truly. The floor is yours. What do you look back on when you think of your time here at SBS?
I guess sort of there's a lot of pride I have about particular shows and you know, I think everything at SBS is a team effort. But it's nice to know that there were particular shows where I got to be a champion in the room when they were being discussed and feel as though, you know, if I hadn't had that voice that they wouldn't necessarily have ended up on our screens.
Yeah.
And I think of some examples like the drama Vikings and Handmaid's Tale, of which you're very familiar.
Oh, look, thank you. Thank you, all the hordes of fans of Handmaid's Tale. Thank you so much for going into bat for that.
Another example which I was thinking of was a little weird entertainment show, weird in terms of not something that SBS would usually buy, but If You Are the One, a Chinese dating series, which was based on a format which first played out in Australia, a show called Taken Out, which was on Channel 10 for a heartbeat before it was ripped off screens for rating too poorly. But I enjoyed it when it played out on 10 because it sort of was this quite ruthless dating show where a single male suitor would come out in front of a panel of women who then all would kind of interrogate the guy and tear him to shreds and brutally put their lights out when they'd lost interest, which happened very rapidly to very many men. And then, oddly enough, that format got picked up in China. I mean, to be honest, the IP got stolen and they ripped it off without having the rights. But
it's brutal out there.
It became a huge hit in China.
Yeah.
And really became known for both how brutal it was, but also sort of what an interesting insight it was into contemporary culture, so that these women would literally ask these male suitors what income they had and then put out their light if they didn't earn enough money, which did raise the ire of the Chinese authorities and forced a bit of a kind of reversioning of the show to sort of take out some of those explicit references to income and wealth.
Sure.
but sort of maintained this status as the most popular show in China at the time, which caught my attention. And I bought it for what we were relaunching as SBS2, as a younger branded channel to attract younger viewers to SBS. And when the initial audience sort of ratings estimates were done by our audience insights team, they looked across the entire schedule. Most of the schedule they anticipated was going to do pretty well. This one show, If You Are the One, they were predicting it would completely bomb. It just stood out as this sort of massive hole in the schedule, which, you know, scared the bejesus out of me. And but then, surprise, surprise, the show actually caught on and we ended up stripping it across every night of the week at one point. And I do remember once just walking around my suburb and just it being that time of day that it was on, sort of early evening, where people now with their massive TVs, because I'm not a peeping Tom, I just sort of want to clarify, but people with their massive TVs, you can see what they're watching in their living room quite easily.
With binoculars.
No binoculars were involved.
Yep.
But it had that kind of moment where people were watching it in multiple homes, and it was getting, you know, write-ups in sort of websites and sort of having that zeitgeist moment. So that was, you know, a very proud moment for me.
Own it. It's fun. And then, of course, had the Australian version.
Yeah. That was cool as well that, I mean, they were doing that already. They were taking Chinese expats, and particularly, so a lot of them being international students that are studying in countries overseas, and then flying them to China and doing special episodes. And I do believe that there is actually one If You Are the One Australian special baby.
And then there was an Australian spin on If You Are the One.
Mm, that's right. It ended up getting remade with Joel Creasy hosting an Australian version. Footnote for history as well, we had Ninja Warrior on SBS2 before Nine ever turned it into the mega hits. Just sort of wanted to share that knowledge.
Top Gear, anyone? Look, yeah, it's all there.
A couple of other things I wanted to mention, just in the documentary space, because
yeah.
I did start out at SBS as the documentary buyer. And this one, you know, I inherited this, so I can't claim any credit at all, but it was a very proud moment for me that we have had the 7UP series on SBS. So I do feel kind of very fortunate to have been able to shepherd 56 and 63 up to screen, been around at SBS long enough to see a couple of iterations of that show, because it is one of the very few series that I think people do literally measure their own life against. And I think, you know, it just is still, you know, such an incredible, innovative piece of television.
Absolutely. And if you weren't going to bring it up, I was going to. Yeah, it just is so special. And it's through SBS, I was able to, you know, interview Michael Apted for the playlist back at the late, great Michael Apted for it. So I don't know what the fate is of the series now that he's no longer with us.
Yeah, but, because I know a lot of the participants kind of begrudged having to be in the public eye every 7 years, and it really was only their affection and respect for Michael Apted that kind of pulled them out again. So it may sadly be the end. I think that, you know, surely at least we'll get kind of some Where Are They Now articles, because I think people are too invested in the lives of these people that we've now seen for, you know, over 60 years.
Yeah, yeah. No, they've grown up before our eyes. What else you got?
Well, it's really hard for me to name individual docos because there have been so many, and it's such a sort of rich area of what SBS does. But some personal favourites. I found an old blog where I'd mentioned this, Terry Pratchett, Choosing to Die, which is a beautiful program about voluntary euthanasia. And he himself was suffering from a degenerative disease, Alzheimer's, and thinking about his future, and formed a very tight bond with people who had ultimately made that decision that they wanted to end their life. Marwan Kul was this sort of oddball documentary about a guy who had really sadly, tragically suffered a major brain injury, but his sort of coping mechanism in some ways was to create this life out of dolls and action figures of everyone he knew in the town where he lived, and photograph them. And so it sort of becomes this story of an outsider artist finding success, but also a very moving story of the man himself.
Yeah, it is. It was not so successfully translated into a feature film with Steve Carell.
I know. Try and forget about that. I've never seen it, and I don't want to.
No. The doc is amazing. Yeah. So go for the doc, not the feature.
And just thinking as well about a couple of films that are really about the kind of extremes that people will go to and kind of put you in that position. So thinking about Man on Wire and Free Solo, and both of which, when you watch them, I think you probably know, I think this all worked out well. and yet at the same time, when you watch, you sort of are living in that moment that no, this is life or death.
Mm-hmm. It's a testament to the storytelling that, like, even when you have seen them and you go back to rewatch them, it's still thrilling.
Yeah.
Yeah. These stories of just incredible feats on a physical level, but truly the story keeps you engrossed, and that's really the marker of a great documentary, isn't it?
Mm. And one last one to mention, because it's coming up to the 20th anniversary of 9/11 this year, and a documentary which I saw all the way back in 2008, so when I began here at SBS, was 102 Minutes That Changed America, which is all contemporary footage shot at the time, a lot of it just handheld. It's sort of 9/11 kind of predated people having sophisticated camera phones, but people did whip out their little camcorders, just, I guess, that human instinct to kind of record the experience that you're having, particularly when it's sort of something just so out of the ordinary. And then, of course, there were, you know, hours and hours of news footage. And so, this is a documentary we've shown a lot on SBS And it really does connect with people because I think generationally, you know, I'm too young to have been around for Kennedy's assassination or these sort of other kind of markers of time. But 9/11 is, you know, a moment that really was this sort of transformative moment around sort of what was happening in this world that we live in and had many, many consequences, many of them very, very negative, of course. But it is a film that really does capture that experience of being there in New York City on that day.
Mm, yeah, incredible.
I said that was going to be the last one. I will just mention one other show which I had, again, can take no credit for or responsibility for whatsoever, but an SBS memory that will always stick with me was when Struggle Street was about to go out and our office building was blockaded by garbage trucks. And you can't say that that happens very, very often in life. So, you know, that's just sort of something that, that lot of, you know, every time a garbage truck drives by, I can think back to my time at SBS.
Remember us well. It was a defining moment here at SBS. People who may not be aware, there was some pre-screening concerns about how certain communities were depicted, and we had a blockade from a local council. Sent the garbage trucks to tell us what they thought of this show they hadn't seen. So it was it's a big day, big deal here at SBS when that happened. But of course, when the show went to air, people realised.
Yeah, I think
there
the
was
sort
more
of
substance than had been suggested.
The controversy died down, but it did manage to make Struggle Street, I think, our sort of most watched program ever outside of sport. And it was one of those few shows that people who knew that I worked at SBS but just would never watch SBS in their life actually kind of went, oh, you know what? I did check out Struggle Street.
So thank you, Councillor. well, we could go on, but you need to go and hand in your security pass.
Yeah.
I've been taking notes for
before I'm dragged out of the building.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, no, it'd just be weird. You don't want to go that way. Ben, it's been real. And truly, having been in a lot of meetings where you're assessing content that goes to air, you have such great taste, and the way you articulate and speak on behalf of audiences, it's always a great thing to admire. And you're very well liked and loved by your colleagues, so you will very much be missed. But truly, don't be a stranger and don't steal all the good shows for Stan. Leave us some.
Well, it's been a real honour, as I said, doing this podcast, but also just working with you over my career here at SBSV. And like, you are one of the stars here, even if people don't always acknowledge it. And I know that with people like you, SBS is in great hands into the future.
Aww. Well, you have to hug when we go to the end, but let's do the sign off.
That's right. Well, it is the end, and it is it for our show, or at least this iteration of it. I'm sure there'll be more playlists to come, and in order to get your playlist, you will have to subscribe to SBS The Playlist wherever you get your podcasts, and give us a lot of stars and leave a nice review because it helps people to find the show. And you can let us know what you thought of the movies and TV shows we discussed on Facebook or Twitter at SBS Movies. And I'm on Twitter at Ben Nguyen TV.
And I'm on Twitter at Anything But Fifi.
And The Playlist is produced by the incomparable Jeremy Wilmot, who I will miss very, very much as well. Until next time. For some.
Question mark? Thank you for listening. And thank you, Ben.
Bye.
Let's go have a drink.